Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Kelly Jean Kelly, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
People who eat more plant-based protein may live longer than those who get more protein from meat, a Japanese study suggests. Researchers followed almost 71,000 middle-aged Japanese adults for an average of almost 20 years. They compared people who ate the smallest amount of plant protein to those who ate the largest amount. The researchers found that those who ate the most were 13% less likely to die during the study. They were also 16% less likely to die of cardiovascular causes. Frank Hu is a medical doctor and the head of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Boston, Massachusetts. He told the Reuters News Service that earlier studies have shown that eating more animal protein is linked to chronic disease and death. He said earlier studies also have shown that eating more plant protein is linked with lower health risks. But most of those studies were done among Western populations, he said. In this Japanese study, consumption of plant protein is quite high, whereas the consumption of animal protein is quite low compared to that in Western populations, he said. Animal protein did not appear to influence length of life in the study, researchers report in the scientific publication JAMA Internal Medicine. During the study, 12,381 people died. That included more than 5,055 deaths from cancer, 3,025 from cardiovascular disease, and 1,528 deaths from other kinds of heart disease. The remaining deaths were the result of cerebrovascular disease. People who replaced just 3% of red meat with plant protein were 34% less likely to die of any cause. They were 39% less likely to die of cancer and 42% less likely to die of heart disease during the study. And those who replaced just 4% of processed meat in their diet with plant protein were 46% less likely to die of any cause. They were 50% less likely to die of cancer. Hu was not involved in the Japanese study. But he said when individuals eat more plant protein foods, such as nuts and lentils, there is major improvement in cardiovascular risk factors. These include blood pressure and body weight. It is worth noting that these plant foods contain not just protein, but also other beneficial nutrients, such as healthy fats, he said. I'm Pete Musto.
This Monday is Labor Day in the United States, a holiday linked to workers' rights and wearing white. That may sound strange, but it is true. Many Americans put away their white clothes on Labor Day and do not wear them again until the following May, after Memorial Day. One reason for the clothing custom relates to the season. In the United States, The months between June and September are summer. The weather is usually hot, including in Northeast cities like Boston, Massachusetts, and New York, New York. Many people there historically wore light-colored clothing in the summertime to keep cool. Judith Martin is an expert on manners, in other words, on how to behave politely. She spoke to Time magazine about the history of wearing white in the summer. She said, Americans in the 1800s and early 1900s wore formal clothes all year long. Wearing white clothes in the summertime may have felt more comfortable because white is of a lighter weight, Martin said. Then, in about the 1930s, wearing white clothes in the summertime became fashionable, too. That is because some wealthy Americans in Northeast cities went on vacation for weeks or months in the summer. They stayed in costly hotels or summer houses. The white clothes they wore there became linked to ease, beauty, and money. But at the end of summer, around Labor Day, they put those white clothes away and returned to their lives in the city, as well as to their darker, heavier clothes. In time, not wearing white after Labor Day became a bit of a fashion rule. Following it showed that you were wealthy, or at least that you knew how to act like you were. Today's fashion magazines, however, advise readers to ignore the rule. They point to Coco Chanel, Kim Kardashian, and Michelle Obama, who have appeared in white in all seasons. But you may want to be careful about wearing white to an American-style Labor Day barbecue. The trouble is not fashion, it is ketchup. If it spills, the popular red tomato sauce can ruin a nice set of clothes. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
An American website reported last month that President Donald Trump asked U.S. government officials to explore using nuclear bombs to stop hurricanes. It claimed that Trump had suggested the targeted use of nuclear bombs to protect the United States against the storms. The president was quick to deny the Axios website report. He published the denial on Twitter. The story by Axios that President Trump wanted to blow up large hurricanes with nuclear weapons prior to reaching shore is ridiculous. I never said this, he tweeted. He added that the report was just more fake news. While Trump denied suggesting such a plan, he would not have been the first person to propose this idea. In fact, the use of man-made technology have long been explored to destroy or weaken large storms. The first suggestion of using a nuclear weapon to fight a hurricane reportedly was made during the 1950s. It is said to have come from a U.S. government scientist during the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, predicts hurricanes and other severe weather events. It also works to keep the public informed about such storms. The scientific agency says it often receives suggestions that nuclear weapons should be used against hurricanes. NOAA addresses the nuking of storms on its website. Needless to say, this is not a good idea, it says. NOAA says the first problem with this idea is there is no good evidence that a nuclear bomb would weaken or stop a hurricane. In addition, the agency noted that such a plan ignores the release of radioactive material in a nuclear blast. This material would fairly quickly move with the trade winds to affect land areas and cause devastating environmental problems, it said. In a much deeper scientific exploration of the issue, NOAA said it would be very difficult for explosives to stop the huge amount of energy produced by a large hurricane. It said a fully developed hurricane creates so much energy that it would be equal to a 10-megaton nuclear bomb exploding every 20 minutes. NOAA made an estimate of the amount of energy required to weaken the strength of a Category 5 hurricane to that of a Category 2 storm. It predicted that would require more than 500 million tons of air to hit a storm with a 20-kilometer-wide eye. It would be very difficult to find a practical way of moving that much air, the agency noted. Another method that was studied for years involved seeding the eye of hurricanes. NOAA reports that seeding experiments were carried out from 1962 to 1983 as part of a U.S. government project called Storm Fury. Scientists used a substance called silver iodide, which can form ice crystals. The goal was to drop silver iodide into hurricane rain clouds. Scientists theorized that the process would weaken wind strength and reduce the storm's intensity. But in the end, NOAA decided that cloud seeding had little chance of success. This was mainly because scientists found that hurricanes contained too much natural ice and too little supercooled water. The seeding experiments also failed to differentiate between the expected results of human intervention and the natural behavior of hurricanes, NOAA said. Another idea involves cooling waters on the ocean's surface. A U.S.-based company called Intellectual Ventures says it has developed a water cooling method to weaken hurricanes. It calls the system Salter Sink. A company video explains the system would use a large pump powered by ocean waves to push hot water from the surface down into cooler water below. The hot water would travel through a plastic container known as a Salter Sink. The idea was that the water being forced down would mix with cooler water and then return to the surface to help weaken a hurricane. A 2012 statement on the Intellectual Ventures website says the system had produced some interesting early results and some interest. However, the company said the technology will require much more extensive testing and research that's better suited for a university or government research group. Several studies have predicted that warming waters in the Atlantic Ocean are expected to increase the number of major hurricanes in the coming years. Currently, the United States and neighboring countries are now entering the most active part of the hurricane season. It remains to be seen whether the number and size of future storms will fuel additional research into new solutions aimed at stopping them. I'm Brian Lynn.
For years, our American history series, The Making of a Nation, has been one of the most popular programs from VOA Learning English. The series started in 1969. Today, we start our series again from the beginning. Generations of school children have been taught that Christopher Columbus discovered the New World. In fact, the second Monday in October is celebrated as a national holiday to honor the European explorer. But October also has a lesser-known observance. October 9th is Leif Erikson Day. So, who was Leif Erikson? Today, Steve Ember tells us about him and other early European explorers.
Leif Erikson was a Norse explorer who sailed around the northeastern coast of what we now call North America about 1,000 years ago. He and his crew returned to Greenland with news of a place he called Vinland. Following his explorations, a few settlements were built. Experts digging in eastern Canada in the 1960s found the remains of a village with houses like those in Greenland, Iceland, and Norway. But the Norse did not establish any permanent settlements in North America. Today, as we relaunch our series, we begin with the story of early European explorers in North America. In the 11th century, Europe was beginning a period of great change. One reason was the religious wars known as the Crusades. These were military campaigns by Christians to force Muslims out of the Holy Land in the Middle East. The Crusades began at the end of the 11th century. They continued for about 200 years. One effect of the presence of European armies in the Middle East was to increase trade. This trade was controlled by businessmen in Venice and other city-states in Italy. The businessmen earned large profits by supplying the warring armies and by bringing goods from the East into Europe. When the European crusaders returned home, they brought with them some new and useful products. These included spices, perfumes, silk cloth, and steel products. These goods became highly valued all over Europe. The increased trade with the East led to the creation and growth of towns along the supply roads. It also created a large number of rich European businessmen. The European nations were growing. They developed armies and governments. These had to be paid for with taxes collected from the people. By the 15th century, European countries were ready to explore new parts of the world. The first explorers were the Portuguese. By 1400, they wanted to control the eastern spice trade. European businessmen did not want to continue paying Venetian and Arab traders for their costly spices. They wanted to set up trade themselves. If they could sail to Asia directly for these products, the resulting trade would bring huge profits. The leader of Portugal's exploration efforts was Prince Henry, a son of King John I. He was interested in sea travel and exploration. He became known as Henry the Navigator. Prince Henry brought experts to his country and studied the sciences involved in exploration. He built an observatory to study the stars. Portuguese sea captains sailed their ships down the west coast of Africa, hoping to find a path to India and East Asia. They finally found the end of the African continent, the area called the Cape of Good Hope. It took the Portuguese only about 50 years to take control of the spice trade. They established trading colonies in Africa, the Persian Gulf, India, and China. Improvements in technology helped them succeed. One improvement was a new kind of ship. It could sail more easily through storms and winds. Other inventions, like the compass, allowed them to sail out of sight of land. The Portuguese also armed their ships with modern cannon. They used these weapons to battle Muslim and East Asian traders. The other European nations would not let Portugal control this spice trade for long, however. Spain's Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand agreed to provide ships, crew, and supplies for an exploration by an Italian named Christopher Columbus. Columbus thought the shortest way to reach the East was to sail west across the Atlantic Ocean. He was right, but he also was wrong. He believed the world was much smaller than it is. He did not imagine the existence of another continent and another huge ocean between Europe and East Asia. Columbus and a crew of 88 men left Spain on August 3, 1492, in three ships, the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. By October 12th, the sailors stood on land again on an island that Columbus named San Salvador. He explored the island and the nearby islands of what are now known as Cuba and Hispaniola. He believed they were part of the coast of East Asia, which was then called the Indies. He called the people he found there Indians. Columbus left about 40 men on San Salvador Island to build a fort from the wood of one of the ships. He returned to Spain with birds, plants, gold, and people captured from the land he explored. Columbus was welcomed as a hero when he returned to Spain in March of 1493. Columbus sailed again across the Atlantic to the Caribbean 5 months later. He found that the fort built by his men had been destroyed by fire. Columbus did not find any of his men. But this time, he had many more men and all the animals and equipment needed to start a colony on Hispaniola. 7 months later, he sent five ships back to Spain. They carried Indians to be sold as slaves. Columbus himself also returned to Spain. Columbus made another trip in 1498. This time, he saw the coast of South America. But the settlers on Hispaniola were so unhappy with conditions in their new colony, they sent Columbus back to Spain as a prisoner. Spain's rulers pardoned him. In 1502, Columbus made his final voyage to what some by then were calling the New World. He stayed on the island of Jamaica until he returned home 2 years later. During all his trips, Columbus explored islands and waterways, searching for that passage to the Indies. He never found it, nor did he find spices or great amounts of gold. Yet he always believed that he had found the Indies. He refused to recognize that it really was a new world. Evidence of this was all around him. Strange plants unknown in either Europe or Asia, and a different people who did not understand any language spoken in the East. Columbus's voyages, however, opened up the New World. Others later explored all of North America. Now you may be wondering about the name of this new land. If Christopher Columbus led the explorations, then why is it called America? The answer lies with the name of another Italian explorer, Amerigo Vespucci. He visited the coast of South America in 1499. He wrote stories about his experiences that were widely read in Europe. In 1507, a German mapmaker, Martin Waldseemüller, read Vespucci's stories. He decided that the writer had discovered the New World and thought it should be called America in his honor. And so it was. Spanish explorers sought to find gold and power in the New World. They also wanted to spread Christianity, which they considered the only true religion. The first of these Spanish explorers was Juan Ponce de León. He landed in North America in 1513. He explored the eastern coast of what is now the state of Florida. He was searching for a special kind of water that Europeans believed existed. They believed that this water could make old people young again. Ponce de León never did find the Fountain of Youth. Also in 1513, Vasco Núñez de Balboa crossed the Isthmus of Panama and reached the Pacific Ocean. In 1519, Hernán Cortés landed an army in Mexico. His army destroyed the ancient empire of the Aztec Indians. That same year, Ferdinand Magellan began his 3-year voyage around the world. And in the 1530s, the forces of Francisco Pizarro destroyed the Inca Indian Empire in Peru. 10 years later, Francisco Vázquez de Coronado had marched as far north as what is now the American state of Kansas, and then west to the Grand Canyon. About the same time, Hernando de Soto reached the Mississippi River. 50 years after Columbus first landed at San Salvador, Spain claimed a huge area of America. The riches of these new lands made Spain the greatest power in Europe and the world.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.